Despite poor decisions made as a teenager, including alcohol, theft and delinquency, and getting married and having a child and becoming divorced before getting out of junior high school, poet Lucille Langday emerged as a decorated author and lifelong advocate for the achievements of girls and women. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Shortly, we'll listen to my conversation with Lucy about her memoir, Married at 14. Jean Wong explores contemporary culture through a reinvention of Greek mythology. And later in the broadcast, Rosemary Manchester and Jean Wong are in conversation about her recently released volume of tales, Sleeping with the Gods. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Lucille Langday's nonfiction and poetry express a clearness of vision and fascination with the world she observes. However, as a young woman, her drive, intelligence, and experience of her environment led her in a direction that might have had a darker outcome. Lucy's memoir, Married at 14, A True Story, published by Heyday Books, explores her romantic impulses as well as reflects on her own evolution as a person. Here's my conversation with Lucille Langday. We, of course, are going to talk about your memoir, Married at 14, but I think I'm going to keep our listeners waiting a few minutes before we find out more about that, because I want to talk first about you're a well-published poet and have been involved in poetry in the Bay Area for many years, and you have a whole career as a scientist. And it seems, and I want you to correct me on this, that you've been involved in exposing math and science to young people and girls in particular, maybe. And,
yes.
And that you've published several other books. So why don't we start there, and then we'll move into your memoir.
Okay. In fact, you mentioned my encouraging girls in math and science, and I did co-author a book called How to Encourage Girls in Math and Science, and I do have a poem I could read about women scientists, and this is called Homage to Henrietta Swan Leavitt and Annie Jump Cannon. The first computers, spinsters, who scanned photographic plates at Harvard College Observatory in the late 19th century, recording the colors and brightness of stars in fine Victorian script. Barred from taking classes and earning a degree, one woman could catalog 500,000 stars in a lifetime, betrothed to the universe. An ordinary person might have cursed all the elements in the spectra. Their work considered too menial for an astronomer. The women knew the sky more intimately than anyone. Henrietta's world was Cepheid variable stars. She watched them day after day, growing dimmer and brighter through weeks and seasons, grains of salt on dark plates. Until the sky told her, the brighter the star, the longer the cycle will take. And she showed the way to measure distances between galaxies, even light years from Earth to the edge of space. Every fact is a valuable factor in the mighty whole, Annie said. And she told the astronomers how to classify stars by temperature and color. O, B, A, F, G, K, M. O, be a fine girl, kiss me. The students would say, missing the irony. And the blue-white, white and yellow-white stars beat like pale hearts millions of light-years away. The yellow, orange, and red ones, colder, were closer now, familiar as lemons, oranges, and apples glowing on the breakfast table in a black lacquer bowl. So these women just did incredible work in astronomy, and I think women have always made contributions to science. They haven't always gotten recognition for it. These women at Harvard College Observatory in the 19th century had the job title computer, and they did the work that electronic computers today do in scanning the photographic plates from the observatory. And so they were the ones that made the discoveries. And then, of course, the professors wrote the papers and took the credit for their work. And Henrietta Swan Leavitt, actually, with her work with Cepheid variable stars, laid all the groundwork for Hubble. And he couldn't have shown that the universe was expanding without her work. After I wrote this poem, since then, there's been a book about her called Miss Leavitt's Stars, and more recently, there's a play about her. So it's late, but it's, I say, better late than never, so she is getting her recognition now. And Annie Jump Cannon, who was the one who figured out how to classify stars by their color and temperature, worked at Harvard College Observatory for 50 years, and in something like the 48th year, she was finally given the title astronomer. And so she began to get her recognition in her lifetime. So it's a story with a happy ending, but my story is that girls really are good in math and science, and they can do it.
How did you get into studying science? I mean, you have a PhD.
Yes, I have a master's in zoology and a PhD in science and math education. And when I was in high school, where I was, as you know, juvenile delinquent, teen mother, I was out of school. But then when I went back to school, one of the things I read was Madame Curie's biography written by her daughter, Eve Curie. I already knew I wanted to be a writer and poet. And then when I read this biography, it just seemed so incredible, the research that she did in physics. And I thought, oh, making scientific discoveries, what a great way to make a living. So I want to be a scientist too. And of course, nobody told me that being either a writer or a scientist was a full-time job. And I thought I could do both. And so I tried to do the best I could, doing a little of both.
In your life, you have melded these two in a way that is expressed through your poetry. I mean, I've not read a lot of your poetry, just exposed to some of it. And it really seems that you weave your wonder and appreciation for the physical world, nature, the universe, into your poetry and into the emotional content of your poetry.
Yes, I do definitely try to do that.
Well, could you maybe read another poem for us?
Okay, well, maybe this will be a lead into my memoir, because I got married the first time when I was 14. I could read a poem about my first wedding.
Okay.
And this is an autobiographical poem. First Wedding. If the sky that day had opened not its blue room, but its gray one, and we had been wed, rain-drenched in Reno, thunder cracking, it wouldn't have mattered, but the sun was out to brighten the walls of the old stone church. All the dolls were long dead by then, cold and waxy in their cribs and shoebox beds on closet shelves, dust collecting like memories. I was 14, wearing new white shoes and my blue-flowered satin Chinese dress. Mark was 3 years older, looking skinny in his rented suit. Our mothers asked the organist to play I Love You Truly, and they crooned and wept. I pretended it was Love Me Tender. The men were silent. My father bowed his head. Standing at the altar, I remembered my blue room. For years, the walls had been shrinking. I saw myself grown huge like Alice in a box small and blue, the door shrunken to shoebox size. I had to burn my way out. Now, in the cool light of the sanctuary, all my wounds were soothed. Mark was smiling. It was hard not to giggle, saying I do. But when we knelt, I thought my dress would rip. But it held, and my hand grew heavy with diamonds. Afterward, we went outside for pictures to put in our white and gold vinyl book. We stood under leaves before a wall of stone, and now I stare at the girl in the blue Chinese dress, O child behind my mirror, smiling, trapped.
Lucille Langday reading from her book of poetry, Wild One.
Yes.
And it is a lead-in to this unlikely story. Your memoir is called Married at 14, A True Story, and you, in fact, were married at 14, and you became a mother shortly after that, and this was not because you accidentally got knocked up, but it was willful and strategic on young Lucy's part. And when I was reading the book, it struck me that you were probably born a 42-year-old or something, you know, that you seemed to have an intelligence and an awareness of others that maybe gave you yourself the perception of a maturity you didn't have. You wanted to get out of the house, and you were defiant and strident and started life early in an unlikely way. And your memoir seems to be a reflection upon that and maybe what it means to you now. But I found it intriguing that I could hear young Lucy's voice. So tell us, first of all, a little bit about your writing of the book and how you manifested that evolving voice throughout the book.
Yes, well, I wanted to capture what I was thinking and feeling as a juvenile delinquent and teen mother. So in some ways, I wasn't mature. I would say I was maybe born at 20, not 42. I definitely had skipped early adolescence, and I was ready to go roaring into adulthood. But I was very defiant and rebellious when I was 13, before I got married. I ran away from home. I took my father's car. I ran away from home with a boyfriend. I cut school. I drank. I smoked. I shoplifted. I told adults just what I thought of them, and often it wasn't good. So I tried to capture what I was thinking and feeling as a troubled teenager, and I really believe I was a troubled teenager. I wanted to show that troubled kids are right about some things. I was right about a lot of things. I witnessed racism and use of racist vulgar language, and I was appalled by it, and I thought it was just outrageous that adults did that. And as a 13-year-old and 12-year-old and 7th and 8th grade, I went to a school. It was Piedmont Junior High School, where the girls had to wear the uniforms and boys didn't, and I said that was unfair and I'm not doing it. I didn't like it that girls had to take home ec and that boys could take shop. I said I'd rather take shop than home ec. And it turned out I was right about these things, because 10 years later, Title IX was passed and it became illegal to have dress codes that affect one gender and not the other. And it became illegal to discriminate in what courses boys and girls can take. They all have to have access to sports. They all have to have access to the whole curriculum. So I was right about some things, but I was wrong about other things. For example, it seemed perfectly logical to me to shoplift. And I thought store owners had more money than other people. The wealth should be more equitably distributed. So, you know, I'll just take what I want. And that was totally wrongheaded. And other things, like I thought teen sex was perfectly okay. I have my period, and I'm attracted to my boyfriend, and all the animals on earth do it. So this is stupid that people say it's wrong. And, you know, and I did act on that, and I had sex for the first time when I was 14 years old, before I got married, and not with my husband, but with previous boyfriend. So I think that in our culture, I was definitely wrong that I was ready for sex and ready for marriage.
But you were somewhat manipulative of your parents constantly. And they, as your poem indicates, I mean, they were at the wedding.
They were at the wedding, yes.
And it was like they couldn't or didn't say no. Or
I was manipulative, and I did tell them if they didn't let me get married, I would run away again or I would get pregnant, and I meant it. And I will say that there were things that I wanted to get away from in my childhood. This is back to the whole idea that this was, you know, something that a conscious strategic plan. It wasn't getting pregnant by accident or something like that. When I was in elementary school, I ran into bullies, and I was bullied, and people, you know, the kids called me names, and boys threw dirt clods at me. And by the time I got to eighth grade, they were calling me whore. So I wanted to get away from school because of that. And I didn't have the safe haven at home that I would have liked. My mother yelled at me a lot. She also spanked me every day till I was 10. And when I hit her, the first time I hit her back, she didn't spank me anymore. But when I tell people my mother behaved that way, sometimes they say, oh, your mother was crazy. Well, she wasn't crazy. She wasn't psychotic or anything. She was a neurotic woman. She'd had a hard life herself. She'd lost her mother when she was 7. She never saw her father again after she was 12. She was raised by adoptive grandparents, and I'm sure that they hit her. And also, about hitting, it was a really common thing in the 50s. Now it's rightfully considered child abuse, and I don't think anybody should hit their kids, and I didn't hit my kids. But my mother wasn't different from many other parents, and my mother never bruised me or injured me, but she spanked me a lot. And also, yelling at your kids was, I think, more common and acceptable then than it is now. Now we call it emotional abuse, but you know, but we didn't in those days, and I wanted to get away from it.
And you were very clear about that you wanted to get away from home.
Yes.
And even though subsequently you had to come back home,
right?
And your evolving relationship with your mother, she ended up being very helpful.
Yeah,
in
she was.
Helping you.
She ended up being very helpful and very supportive, and getting out of home turned out to be out of the frying pan and into the fire, because when I had a conflict with my husband, he didn't spank me. He gave me a black eye, and that was the reason that I divorced him the first time. So I married him when I was 14, baby at 15, divorced at 16, married again at 17, and then I left him again at 18 because he was adamantly opposed to my going to school. He was a high school dropout himself, and I guess he didn't want me to get ahead of him. So being married did turn out to be more confining, and it was definitely worse than living with my parents had been.
We're talking with Lucille Langday about her memoir, Married at 14. And you just talked about that whole, what could be a typical cycle if you're in high school and breaking up with your boyfriend and getting back together. But this was a little different. You were married. You had a kid. You weren't living at home. And you thought you were just going to walk into this adult life, and you really had a romantic sense about all this.
I had a very romantic sense, and some people don't pick up on that. They think, oh, she just married to get away from home. Where's the love? Well, I felt madly in love with him. You know, now maybe we could call that a crush or infatuation, or it's not mature love, but I was crazy about him, and I was really in love with romantic love itself, in addition to being in love with my husband. The whole idea of it, I thought, was the answer to everything. It was what solves all our problems and gives us a happy life.
And what changed in you that you refocused yourself into academics, though you still were engaging in a lot of immature relationships, one mm-hmm. might say, you then became very goal-oriented.
Well, I think I was always goal-oriented, like wanting to get married and developing this whole plan and finding a husband and falling in love and getting out of the house. That was a goal. It was a goal that I fulfilled when I was 14 years old. And then I discovered that that was not the appropriate goal. I should have been putting this energy into trying to get an education and do something with my life. Then when I was out of school, I was out of school between the ages of 14 and 17, and I wanted to get a job. And a lot of people, when they wouldn't even give me an application when they learned I dropped out of school after eighth grade.
And you didn't get that. Because it seemed like you saw yourself as completely capable, completely.
Yeah, that's right. I thought I knew everything I'd ever need to know. I thought I knew how to do math. I thought I could read and write. And I didn't get what the piece of paper was necessary for, but I did ultimately realize there were a whole lot of things that I didn't know. But I did discover that I finally had to lie to get a job and say that I dropped out of school after 10th grade, not 8th grade. And then I got the job as a phone girl at Chicken Delight.
Do you still think of yourself as a rebel?
I guess I do, because I've continued to rebel against things like this idea that that women aren't as good as men in math and science. And so in some ways I am still a rebel, and I think that it can be very positive to be a rebel. You can be rebelling against war. You can be rebelling against environmental destruction. But the important thing to do is to find those constructive uses, because when you're a confused teenager, being a rebel can be self-destructive and counterproductive in the way that it manifests. But I do want to say one more thing about these young rebels and juvenile delinquents and teen mothers, is that, you know, I don't think I'm an exception in being redeemable. I think that in general, all of these kids are redeemable and can have wonderful futures.
I was so intrigued with your relationship with your mother, and then the way you talk about her at her death was really kind of a lovely part of the book.
Yeah, in the first half of the book, you get my mother from my teen point of view, so you get all the faults I found with her as a teenager. And then in the second half of the book, particularly that essay you're talking about called Time Out, you know, I show my appreciation of her, and I also show how I came to understand her and see her differently as an adult.
Yeah, and we didn't talk about your dad at all, uh-huh. and he is such a big part of the book too, his love for you. And
yes, he always encouraged me in every way, and he was also a very interesting character. He was a very intelligent man, and he was a very talented amateur photographer, but he put a lot of his intelligence into gambling. He was a gambler who played cards for the house at a card club in Emeryville. And he also was once kicked out of a casino as a young man because he could count cards at blackjack, and they realized he was winning too much. He must be counting cards. But he also, when in playing poker, he told me that he was a winner because he could calculate the probability of something in his head, so he would get the probability that he was going to get a card to beat the other person. And if he didn't think that probability was high enough, that then he wouldn't bet and he would fold. So he was strategizing all of the time like that. But he was definitely a very interesting person, and he also gave me a lot of encouragement.
I want to mention that I think that the fact that this is set in, or you grew up in Oakland, and it's a California story. It
yes.
really is a California story, and you call yourself a California girl in the book. I will say I also loved your references to hair. And those, you were a young teenager in the days of very big hair, and that was considered a little bit of rebellion, too.
Yes, it definitely was.
And from some of the pictures in the book, you had some pretty high hair.
Yes. Yeah, I braided my hair on top into a 4-inch dome, and I always had long hair, and then I let my long hair hang down my back. But it looked like I was wearing a helmet.
So, Lucille Langday, thanks so much for coming in today. And I wonder if you would leave us with a poem.
This is another nature poem, and this is the last poem in my latest poetry collection, The Curvature of Blue. First rays of light falling on pointed red petals and pinnate leaves of the desert trumpet. The glow that reveals slim blooms of the scarlet bugler, the breast of the scarlet tanager, the cap of the red-headed woodpecker, the calliope hummingbird's throat. Radiance announcing the vine maple's purple-red polygamous flowers growing in clusters, its smooth red-brown bark and paired red seeds. Each morning, let us applaud the brightness that unfolds to show the abundance of all things red, red bays and red oaks, red coral, red clover, red-shafted flickers, and even red pandas, even red ants.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you today.
Great, me too.
Letter to send in a space capsule. I lived on the third planet circling an ordinary star, at the edge of a spiral galaxy 2 million light years from the Andromeda Nebula. We called it Earth. In spring, the mock cherry trees were flocked with white blossoms when maples blazed green, and hummingbirds with long, narrow beaks and brilliant throats sucked nectar from red and orange flowers. In summer, the sky was pale blue and sometimes feathered with clouds like the wings of giant swans. When our star, known as the sun, was at its peak, the pavement of our streets began to sizzle, forming black tar beads, and ice cream, sweet and sticky, dripped from children's cones. As the earth tipped away from the sun, maple trees turned red, liquid ambers gold, and falling leaves swirled in every gust of wind. When no leaves clung to the trees, the year's final season arrived like a bride adorning the world with ice and white lace. The planet was mostly covered with oceans that filled great basins surrounding continents and islands that rose green and lush from the radiant water that surged and frothed at every shore. I was born 20 centuries after the birth of a prophet many considered the son of the creator of the earth, the heavens, and everything living. My species, Homo sapiens, was one of many warm-blooded creatures with 4 limbs, a backbone, and enamel teeth. Our brains were large, and we figured out how to shatter atoms and even fuse nuclei, releasing energy like the heart of a star. We built enough nuclear bombs to incinerate or irradiate all life and fill the atmosphere with ash. Needless to say, most people didn't want to use them, but we spoke many languages and lived by different customs, and nations that couldn't reach agreement often waged war. As we burned fossil fuels to run our factories and cut down forests to build our towering cities, the earth grew warmer, the air turned grayer, and the polar ice caps crumbled into the sea. One by one, flowers, frogs, worms, and birds began to disappear. It may sound strange, but most people cared deeply about the planet and each other. This is what I know. The language in which I write is English, a strongly stressed Indo-European tongue with regional variations and peculiar spelling. I hope the clapper rail, with its brown and white striped belly, still inhabits the salt marsh, and the scarlet bugler still blooms each spring in the coastal hills of California, my home. I hope the rain still falls on fields and rivers. I hope you can decipher this code.
I'm Suzanne Lang. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea and my conversation with Lucille Langday. Lucy and I talked about whether we might be related, and, well, that will just have to be explored in another book that one of us will have to write. Stay with us. Coming up, Rosemary Manchester talks with Jean Wong about her new book, Sleeping with the Gods, as well as books that fit well under your pillow.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill. For my darling, I love you, and I always.
Jean Wong brings us nine tales of the gods: Apollo, Hestia, Mercury, Venus, transformed into a modern vernacular. Here's Rosemary Manchester talking with Jean Wong and Sleeping with the Gods.
Your book is called Sleeping with the Gods, Immortal Stories by Jean Wong. I love it. I've been dying to ask you where the inspiration came. Well, from the gods, of course. But the inspiration for these, they're unusual stories.
Well, a lot of people are asking me, well, you must know a lot about, you know, Greek and Roman gods. But to tell you the truth, I know nothing about, you know, I've never been a, well, I did take 2 years of Latin. But other than that, I'm not some classical scholar of any kind. I'm in a Friday writing class in Sonoma, and we're assigned a topic. We assign each other a topic every week. Well, this particular week, someone assigned Mercury. And so I walk in the class, and some people had written on the element Mercury, you know, like in a thermometer or something like that. But one girl wrote about the god Mercury, and she described his characteristics. And as you know, Mercury is fast, he's changeable, not really very reliable, he can lie. And when she was describing him, I thought, I used to have a boyfriend just like that. And I just, you know, and it was that kind of situation where you're in a, you kind of meet someone and you kind of want it to work, and he's gorgeous and you like him, but there he says or does something that you go, wait a minute, that was weird or that's strange, you know, but you want it to work. And so you just sort of keep, so anyway, that was the impetus. And then I wrote that one, and after that, I thought of Venus, and I thought of, you know, another one and another one, and, you know, I was on a roll.
You certainly were. Yeah. And it, for me, it really, really works to see how you've, the various ways in which you work the stories around the characteristics of the gods and goddesses. I want to read to our audience what Terry Arrett wrote about your book. She says, Sleeping with the Gods romps through the unexpected intersection of everyday life and myth. But not the myths you learned in school. Each god or goddess has a contemporary persona. Mercury is a beachcombing gigolo in Kauai. Venus is a hitchhiker along the Columbia River Gorge. Hestia is a caretaking android. Whether you're familiar with the classic tales or discovering the gods for the first time, you'll find these divine encounters engaging, humorous, haunting, sexy, and savvy, with deep insights into human nature.
That particular blurb was wonderful, because, and I often read it myself because not only is it glowing, but it also gives you – it's a hard book to sort of describe explain to people, but it completely, in a nutshell, tells you what it's about.
You're doing a lot of readings. How's that going? What's it like?
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I have one story in there especially that I – enjoy so much. It takes place at the Zen Center. It's a total fiction, but I used to belong to the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center out here in Santa Rosa. And it's really my favorite story. And I find myself, I keep reading it because I love reading it so much. But then I thought, there's a lot of stories I haven't read. So today I'm going to be reading it another venue. And so I'm gonna do Zeus. Zeus is another difficult story. It's the myth where Zeus transforms himself into a swan and rapes Leda. And this is extremely, you know, Yeats wrote a very famous poem on it. And people have written on this many times. So it was particularly challenging for me because I was thinking, how on earth am I going to have Zeus be a contemporary dude, you know, walking around, and how is he going to get himself to be a swan and rape somebody? Yeah. And also the subject of rape is sensitive.
Of course
it is. Women are, you know, kind of a little nervous about that subject.
That's
so I'm interested in how it's going to go today, you know, whether people are going to go, oh, yikes, you know, and run, or whether they'll, you know, be sympathetic to the way it was done.
I was a little nervous myself in approaching that story.
Well, the one thing that I hope I made clear in that was Zeus was just as much a victim of history and himself and his own karma as the person he victimized, you know. In all of the stories, you know, there were a lot of things where, especially the men, were not that sympathetic. But I wanted to make sure that you could see where they were coming from.
Yes.
And so that you felt that there was this sort of encounter between the divine and the human, but each had their own issues, and they each kind of ensnared and entrapped each other in a way, you know, so, yeah.
And you captured the essence of the persona of each of them, and it made me reflect on the importance of those myths. Your book has, I think, a universal appeal, and I wanted to ask you, it's the gods and goddesses from the Greek and Roman mythology.
Right.
Who have stayed with us and who have more universal recognition.
Well, I think that what is appealing, you know, these Greek and Roman gods had that human frail, you know, they always had some kind of little, you know, Achilles heel, so to speak.
Achilles,
you
know? There's another name we recognize. Yes, yes.
You know, they always had a certain weakness or a tendency to overdo it, or they blew it, or they pursued somebody and somebody turned into a tree, or, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
Right. So let me remind our listeners, I'm talking to Jean Wong, and that her website is under her name, Jean Wong. And the name of the book is Sleeping with the Gods, Immortal Stories. Right. I want to tell you, Jean, how happy I am to find a smaller size book. It's complete. You know, I want more, but this one is complete in itself. And it's easy to carry around. You can put it in your pocket. You can put it in your backpack. You can tuck it in under your pillow when you're reading it at night. I'm a terrific fan of smaller books. And I'm sure, did you deliberately set out to think, well, I'll keep this one small? It's how many pages? Is it 100
It's 100,
pages?
108 pages.
108 pages.
Yeah.
Perfect.
But I didn't know. As a matter of fact, they were originally six, and I was talking to one person who considered publishing it with his small, very small press, and he said, would you, you know, consider adding a couple more stories to give the collection a little more heft? I love that word, heft.
That's great.
and so I, you know, just pulled out three more stories out of the hat, which I'm really glad I did, because it really seemed to round things out. But I know what you're saying. I mean, I have this, I mean, this is a pretty shallow confession, but when I go to the library, oftentimes, I will just look down the shelf, and I'll pick the thinner volumes.
Yes.
Mainly because I feel if somebody can't say something, mm-hmm. it's going to take so long in this huge volume to mm-hmm. say something.
Yes.
You know, they're probably long-winded.
Yes.
You know, there's
long-winded.
A story to be
yeah.
told, and mm-hmm. you know, tell it.
Right.
You know, for goodness sakes, just
yes.
don't go on and
yes.
on and on about it. You know, and I felt mm-hmm. feel that way even about biographies. I mean, unless
yes.
you're doing really scholarly, comprehensive work, you know, make it interesting.
Yes.
Keep the reader engaged.
Yes, and
yeah.
don't tell me everything.
Yeah, right. I don't need to know everything.
The same thing
yeah.
about memoir. Don't tell
right.
me everything.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Do you think you'll do more with Gods and Goddesses?
I haven't actually thought of it. I'm actually working now on – I've written a lot of memoir pieces, but they're memoir oh. pieces, unlike sort of your typical memoir where it's just telling you about the life each one of, in fact, I'm going to, the name of the story, name of the title is going to be Do You See Me Here, which is the title of one of the stories. And then it'll say, Do You See Me Here? And Other Tales of Personal Folly. And the book will be divided up into things like mystery or insight or folly or, you know, so the chapters will not, instead of a memoir where you sort of talk about your life and kind of these sequence of things that happened to you, each of them will be stories, will be shaped as a story and stand out by itself. And it'll have, you know, kind of like that, what a story needs, a kind of arc and a good ending, a surprise ending and everything. So in that way, it's a little bit different than your, mm-hmm. you know, da-da-da-da type memoir. Hopefully it won't be boring.
I would read that story. Yes.
I just finished an essay, which I just posted it actually mm-hmm. last week on my blog, which is What is Story? And the thing that really occurs to me most of all is that, you know, if you get married and your husband cheats on you and you start drinking and then you commit suicide, that's not really a story. In other words, suffering is not, your tales of woe. Mm-hmm. are not a story. And mm-hmm. I have lots of tales of woe,
yes.
but that's not going to be interesting to anybody.
That's,
you know, in
mm-hmm.
fact, it'll just, it's a bummer to mm-hmm. read about somebody's tale mm-hmm. of woe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you take situations like that and somehow, you know, have maybe a tale of woe, but juxtapose it to another setting or something else where, you know, one part of the puzzle, you know, jumps across the room and fits into the other part of the puzzle and creates, you know, a story, a real story, you know. So,
now,
yeah.
How did you learn how to do that?
Well, that's what I, you know, sometimes I think that there is such a thing as a muse because, like in the one with Anne Girona, the story yes. that was one of my favorite, an incident happened to me in real life, which was a woe is me story. And mm-hmm. I kept thinking, well, how am I going to, you know, da 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 da. And, you know, puzzle did jump, mm-hmm. and I mm-hmm. went, aha, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think there is that kind of muse. People talk about that.
There's
you know,
a muse.
There seems yes. to be something that just sort of mm-hmm. all of a sudden you go, you know, there it is, as clear. Mm-hmm. And some of the things I've written, I can hardly believe that it was written by me. I mean, I'll look at it and I said, how did I cough that one up?
Jean, one of my favorite stories in the book is the first one about Mercury. And people who know me will know why I immediately glommed onto it, because it has a ukulele in it. Of course. he has a ukulele of Kona wood, and so do I. So I bonded with him immediately. But would you read a portion of the beginning of the story of Mercury?
Okay. And, of course, each story has a little description of the god there. And in the beginning, Mercury, it says, Mercury, the messenger god, who wore winged sandals. He made a lyre, filched cattle, and is known for thievery. Later, after Kailani gave it some thought, she realized it was impossible. He couldn't have come out of the ocean with a ukulele in his hand. But that's how she remembered him, the sun behind him like a halo, salt water dripping down the instrument's soft koa wood. Recently divorced, she was licking her wounds on the shores of Kauai, sprawled longer than was comfortable in the hot sun, trying to read a book with a drink that had grown warm. This is what she'd yearned for, but it seemed unlikely that even the gods could have sent her someone so utterly handsome, creamy golden tan, thick bundles of blonde locks, eyes that shimmered with facets of blue and green. Was there even an occasional flare of violet? He plopped himself down beside her. She waited for the pickup line. Do you have the time? Can I borrow a match? Weren't you at the party last night? Do you play? He proffered the ukulele, his long tapered fingers wrapped around the instrument's neck. He smiled with such immediacy and confidence, she was certain his overtures towards women were never turned down. Kailani was probably one of the few people that day on the beach who did indeed know how to play, and she eerily sensed that was why he had approached her. Cradling the small, figure-eight-shaped ukulele in one arm, she strummed Ke Kale Nehao, the Hawaiian wedding song, the most beautiful and famous song of the islands. Their eyes locked, as if in a ceremony between them had already taken place. In rare harmony, they sang the final lines. Ele, ele, oe now, oe now. Ele, oe now. You play well. You sing well, she replied. Where are you from? I'm a planet unto myself. He smiled. But looking at you, it's hard to remember where I ever was or will be. The smile dissolved. His eyes turned inward as if remembering a forgotten past. Actually, I'm from Chile. My father had the first vineyard there. They called him King of the Grapes. But then he got into the armament business. He paused. It was as if unable to break away from some memory. That changed him. There are many stories to tell about those days. The corners of his mouth tightened. He blinked, as if he'd just become aware of her again. When his eyes settled languorously on her, she was glad she had picked a splashy hibiscus and tucked it behind her ear. Under his inspection, she gave a toss of her head, her rich dark hair swinging to one side in endless thick strands. She was used to tourists taking note of her exotic Eurasian cast, part Hawaiian, with a nose that carried a perky tilt from some Caucasian ancestry. King of the Grapes, Kailani said. My grandfather was called King of Taro, the plant we used to make poi. He lived in Honolulu. And we are royalty, he exclaimed. His face flickered joyfully like a candle. I am real royalty, she boasted, but I deign to call you cousin. Then we are prince and princess, he jumped up and took her hand. Come, let us run and reign. They scampered like children, laughing, zigzagging in and out of the water. She would never have been able to keep up with them if he hadn't been holding her hand. His feet lifted from the ground as if in flight. Nimble, quick, lunging, turning, leaping, they flew together down the edge of the shore, up through the foliage and trees, darting in and around picnic tables, finally collapsing under a great coconut palm. You're faster than a beam of light, she panted. And you are a dazzling sprite of grace, he countered. He took her hand. I see your fingers were created for harps and instruments with strings. But your hands, they are the hands of a dancer, a weaver, a spinner of the finest filaments of gold. Like an enchantment, sapphire pools gleamed in his eyes. And you, she found herself saying, are the master of the spoken line, a teller of tales, the god of games, the alchemist of words. Afternoon passed into twilight as they continued their light, fanciful bantering charged with jubilant energy. They watched dazed, as if for the first time the sky arched over them with gentle strands of pinks, oranges, purples, the island's final act of loveliness before nightfall. Did you want to see my place? He asked almost shyly. I think I have a pizza in the freezer. I'm starving, she said. They stared at one another. Everything they did seemed ordinary and at the same time otherworldly. Sometimes Kailani felt like they were acting parts they'd played many lifetimes before. What is your name? She whispered, almost as if she already knew the answer. Mercury, he said.
Beautiful. That was Jean Wong reading from her just published book called Sleeping with the Gods. Immortal Stories. Oh, Jean, you read that so beautifully. And I love every detail in it. When she first discovers the sapphire in his eyes, and then later you you refer back to. Beautifully done. Uh-huh. Oh, congratulations. That's a lovely
you.
Book.
Thank you.
Jean, is there anything else you'd like to talk about that your listeners would like to know about you or your work?
Well, it was just it's a lot of fun to write, and I think it'll be a lot of fun to read. I just hope that people won't be put off with the idea that this is about Roman and Greek gods, and it's some kind of boring, thing under some tomb. It's mm-hmm. definitely not. It's mm-hmm. these are all contemporary situations, and I hope readers will be able to connect to it in their own personal lives.
I hope so too. and the hard work that you put into the writing makes it easy for the reader, and the writer does the work and the reader gets to enjoy it. So thank you so much for putting together this book, and I look forward to more of your writing.
Well, thanks so much.
And it's thanks so much for coming in. I've been talking to Jean Wong. Her last name is Wong, W-O-N-G, spelling it, so you'll be sure to get to the website where you can find out how to get her book. You can also get it on Amazon. And we're working on getting it in the local bookstores. Jean is putting it in the local libraries, and I'm sure the word will spread. Yeah.
Thanks,
Jean.
Hestia, the goddess of hearth and home, known for her mild, gentle personality. The miso was perfect. Mr. Odo made a little sound with his teeth as he gave the cloddy broth a stir. Hestia smiled, her hands folded on her lap. "You are getting so fat lately," a low titter came trickling from her throat as her hand covered her mouth. "You don't have to make all those noises on my account. I know you like anything I cook." Mr. Oda did not reply. He knew if he started talking, it would only encourage her. Actually, she wasn't really supposed to be sitting at table with him, but it was comforting to have her company during meals. When his wife died 2 years ago, he remembered how surprised he was at the painful texture of his loneliness. After his retirement and 70th birthday, he gave in to family pressure and brought home the very product that had made his company famous. Hestia rose, her chair scraping the floor. She started to ladle more miso into his bowl. "No, no," Mr. Odo covered it with his head. "Please, very good. Not that hungry today."
"You always say that, but then you end up stuffing yourself."
She pushed a dish of tofu and vegetables towards him.
"Here, pour that down the hatch."
Her voice went up a pitch. Mr. Odo frowned. "Have you been watching American TV again?"
"Oh, no, I am much too busy."
Hestia's eyes clicked up in alarm. Her lower lip turned downward in a little pout. She really was quite adorable. He had to admit he'd grown fond of her. It would be hard to trade her in. Not only that, there would be talk. After all, it was his company that had created the first viable companion, not some clunker that could just turn, bend, and lift, but someone with a personality and intelligence to match its physical dexterity. His advertising team had been brilliant. They had named her Hestia after the one Greek goddess who had been so pliable and accommodating that there wasn't even a story about her in Greek literature. Hestia was responsible for tending the hearth and keeping order at home. Her quiet domesticity never warranted a myth concerning any of her actions. In these times of change, with Japanese women wanting to join the workforce, the public demand for his company's product had been overwhelming. Still, she needed adjustment. She was, how to put it, off-center, not quite wah, not harmonious enough. Mr. Oda was getting closer to the source of the problem. It was that circuit board he'd ordered from California. Those renegade engineers had too much independence. In Japan, what would be viewed as excessive, Americans considered artistic. As his mind began to remap her circuitry, Hestia cried out much too loudly, "Are you going to shut me down again tonight?" This was another flaw. She had become anxious about bedtime. She seemed to sense when she was about to be shut down and didn't understand the concept of rest. "Hestia?"
Mr. Older lowered his voice, his words steady and patient. Remember how important it is to have some time off. You old goat, you need to rest. House very messy. Hestia needs to clean at night. Hestia? He fingered the remote control. He didn't like to overuse the sleep button. Hestia shrugged her shoulders and went into the kitchen. He saw the pale blue hue of her ears, an indication that she was mildly unhappy. This was a recent feature for customers who were alarmed about the knee incident in Osaka. A faulty male model had kicked an elderly woman in the knee, badly tearing her cartilage. Follow-up studies indicated the woman had been most abusive, calling him names such as Tinhead and Dumbdroid, and the android had built up an excessive amount of heat, triggering resentment. Now ears gave an indication of their emotional state. Green was neutral and placid, but colors on the far end of each spectrum were to be avoided. A mild blue was okay, as you wanted the robot to have a certain level of frustration that would stimulate problem-solving and learning. But a gray or black was a danger sign with anger and aggression an imminent possibility. Similarly, yellow indicated energy and buoyancy, a healthy sign. Yet a bright orange or red was undesirable. This meant extreme happiness and could lead to unpredictable levels of attachment and longing. Red was a color that filled Mr. Oda with the most distaste. He was fastidious in his habits and lifestyle and dreaded any sort of excess. The challenge was to construct a bot that had enough heart to be empathetic, but not so impassioned that feelings got in the way of service. The most desirable design was nuanced, deft, subtle, like fresh spring air, light and refreshing, never turning to blow harshly in your face and make your eyes blink.
Thank you, Rosemary Manchester and Jean Wong. Lucia Lang Day joined me earlier in the broadcast. I'm Suzanne Lang. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. You can listen to us anytime on krcb.org. Subscribe to us on iTunes and download our podcast. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.